Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Don Williams hosting today Inside College Soccer. And today I've got one of our own staff as a guest. It's a man that I've known for quite a few years now. And I wanted to bring him on. I wanted everybody to be able to hear his story a little bit. And then we'll talk to him about the state of college soccer, how he sees things. So we've got SR USA senior staff member, Andre Luciano. Hey, Andre, how are you?
I am doing well, Don. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, sure. We've been threatening to do this for a while now, and I'm glad we both found the time to be able to sit down and do it. So, Andre, I think I want to start this out by hearing a little bit about your journey. You have a quite unique beginning to what your perspectives were about soccer when you were very young. The environment you grew up in, and then what it ended up developing to, I find a very inspiring story. And I thought I'd ask you to kind of tell that story for us a little bit here.
Okay. Well, I was originally born in Italy and moved to the U.S. when I was one. And my father was a businessman, and we traveled a lot. And my father decided to open some businesses in Latin America. And so my mother and I, when I was two, moved to Brazil. And we lived in a variety of different places in Latin America, but primarily in Sao Paulo. And so I grew up in a completely different perspective in terms of what a child grows up here in the U.S. But, you know, and also in relation to what the game, you know, gave me. And so, you know, growing up from 73 until 83, I think that's when I came back in 83. My exposure to the game was completely different. You know, what youth soccer, you know, how it was in Brazil, just a completely different way of doing things. You know, I didn't play club soccer. I mean, I was part of Sao Paulo FC's I was a member. My family was at the club, but I never had played organized soccer. You know, I played handball and different things like that. But, you know, soccer was never a thing that I did it in terms of an organized fashion. And when I moved back to the U.S. when I was in the sixth grade, because I moved back and forth, I just never really thought about playing club. And back then in the 80s, you know, club soccer wasn't a big thing. I think mostly AYSO, and there were some organized things, but I didn't play an organized version of club soccer until my freshman year in high school. And we were just having some sort of intramurals, or, you know, I think it was a P class. And our coach, Randy Minigal, came up to us and, you know, and looked at me and it's like, hey, have you ever played before? I'm like, yeah, I mean, I played in Brazil, you know, growing up in Brazil, but not on a team. And he, you know, I said, what do you think you're best at? I'm like, oh, I'm a goalkeeper, you know, I have good hands. And I feel like that's probably my best position. He's like, well, hey, try out for our JV team. And so I tried out for the JV team. And I made the JV team as a freshman, although everybody thought there's no way this kid's going to be, you know, an athlete. And lo and behold, you know, Randy Minigal, he had won six state titles in a row, you know, four at Rancho and three at Chaparral High School, or two at Chaparral High School at that point. And our varsity team was ranked number three in the country, and it had like 46 game win streak. Well, our starting goalkeeper became academically ineligible. And so now I'm the only other goalkeeper. And so I was pulled up from JV to play varsity soccer as a freshman, never having played club before, on the number three team in the country. And our next game, we lost, 1-0 to Clark High School. Sam Powers slipped in, got a toe poke in. We won, lost 1-0. I was crushed, devastated. I'd lost a streak, for our team. And I'll never forget our seniors, that such influential guys, seniors and juniors on the team, just turned around and like, hey, we're the one to let you down. If you let one goal, in, we should be able to score 4 or 5 based on who we are. So this isn't on you. So that kind of changed my whole trajectory. So we went on and won state that year. I was a freshman goalkeeper, won state, had this, joined a varsity or a club team, a legit club team in Vegas. And, I thought I was on this path, this trajectory. But back in the day in the 80s, no one really talked about how to go to college, right, Don? It was just like, right. You didn't have that many programs and that wasn't a discussion that you had. And, you didn't have social media and different people helping you out with the process. Was either you're good enough and you're going to, make it. And a lot of it back then was all based on whether or not you made a state team. And if you made the state team and you made the ODP team, and you made the, you went to regional camp, and if right. You made the regional camp, you were holdover for regional camp, and you have all the college coaches there. That was a big recruiting event. The regional camp was a huge recruiting event back in the day. And if you were a holdover, you would get, invited to the national camp. And that was your street cred as a player, right? Is that you were a holdover ODP regional player. Well, I never made a state team in my 6 tries in Nevada. And so I never got that opportunity to get that full exposure, except for when we were playing, winning state cup and things like that. So my senior year, I thought I was going to go to UNLV. That was my dream. Danny Anderson, who had played before me at Chaparral High School, went to UNLV. Harry Fields was a goalkeeper beforehand, went to UNLV. And so I thought this is going to be my natural path, is exactly what they did. This is what I'm going to do. And, but that didn't happen. Coach Barter didn't see it that way. He didn't think I was, a good enough player at that time. And in hindsight, after all those years, he was right. I wasn't, I was a 145 pound kid, 6'1", lanky, quick goalkeeper. But most importantly, my academics, it was never a priority because my family never stressed that for me. And so, I came out of high school with probably going into my senior year, I probably had like a 2.5 GPA. And then I had an incredible English teacher by the name of Bobby Cartwright. And she looked at me and she said, you're not stupid. You're a smart kid. You just choose to be, you choose to be the way you are because it's socially, it's easier for you to handle that, that aspect of it, being the fun guy, the being the person everybody wants to be hanging out with. And so that kind of changed my thought process. And, my senior year, I, mostly A's and B's, and I got my grades to a 2.76, but I had never studied for the ACT, never studied for the ACT, was never told to take the ACT. And so I was never able to take a test on the testing day. And so I had to take the ACT on a non-testing day. And basically that made me an NCAA non-qualifier. My GPA and my test scores, and it wasn't taken on an official ACT test date. It was taken at a different time. And so now I didn't have any, I'm going into my senior year, I don't have any options. And so I decided I'm not going to go to college. My parents are like, we're not helping you financially. We don't have money for you to go wherever you want. And so you're just going to work. All my stepbrothers all work for themselves and everyone went to college. And so that was the narrative. Well, I love the game and play the game a lot. And so I got lucky. I was playing at a men's Hispanic league game for a team called Limon, which was our restaurant sponsor. And we were playing in a game, and I had a player named Edson Rico that I had played with in club, and he was in the kind of same boat. So he and I were playing, and I was lucky because I was never rude to the referees, and I had a good reputation with the referees. And the referee by the name of John Kennedy, who here in Las Vegas, who was well known, Very well known. My name, you know, John, right? Recommended myself and Edson Rico to Mike Pantaleon at Yavapai College to come out and watch us play. It's like, there's some good kids here. They're not going to college. Let me connect you with some of these kids. And he knew what our schedule was like. And so Mike Pantaleon came to this game, you know, approached us afterwards. And, you know, I listened to his pitch, you know, it's, hey, I'm starting a brand new soccer program at in Prescott, Arizona called Yavapai. And I am like, what is that? You know, I had zero clue what that was. And I literally took the brochure, I listened, and I threw the brochure away in the garbage can afterwards. So a couple of months later, I think about it, I give him a call. I mean, I literally had to try to figure out how to get a hold of this coach of a school that I couldn't pronounce or even spell. And, you know, we didn't have the internet. So I had to like call directory and try to find us. I mean, it was the process, right?
Right.
Well, finally, I get a hold of him on the phone. I mean, email was not even a thing. Right. So I finally get him on the phone and I'm like, hey, Coach Mike, this is Andre Luciano. Just wanted to connect with you. And he's like, oh, this is nice. Nice to hear from you. Like, hey, can I take a visit? And so he's like, sure, come on out. And I went, you know, on a visit, and we didn't have a field, we didn't have a team, but he had a vision. He's like, we're going to be a really good team. This is what we're going to do. We're going to compete. We're going to win national titles. And I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever. Right. I'm just going to go to college. This is going to be fun. Well, when I got there, the first 2 days of preseason, right away, we could tell we're going to be good. And, you know, we lost one game in 2 years. The first year, we weren't able to go to the NCAA or the NJCAA tournament due to some technicality with the conference. And then the second year we went on an amazing run and, you know, we won the national championship. We lost one game in 2 years. We won a national championship. I had a fantastic run during the region playoffs, the Central Division playoffs, whatever it was, and then a national tournament. And I'll never forget this, you know, national champions, you know, I was named player of the year and as a goalkeeping, you know, the tournament MVP for goalkeepers. And I thought that was it. That's it. You know, I'm done. I don't know what else I'm going to do. And sitting at a basketball game with my teammates, watching a basketball game during the winter, and Mike Pantaleon comes flying through the gym, looks at me, he's like, get over here now. And I'm like, oh man, I'm in trouble. I don't know what I did. Like, Jerry Yeagley's on the phone from Indiana University. He wants to talk to you. And I'm like, who's Jerry Yeagley? I had zero clue who he was. And he's like, what do you mean? That's Indiana University. That's the godfather of soccer. In college soccer, get in here now. And so I get on the phone with Coach Yeagley, and he has a great conversation with me. And if you know Coach, you know, he can captivate anybody. And he's like, we want to bring you on a visit. I'm like, okay, when? He's like, in 3 days. I'm like, okay, I got finals. And he's like, can you figure this out? And so figured it out. And the rest was history. You know, I went to Indiana University and had a good career, great career over there. You know, and it came down to like who you know, right? And so because I went to IU and it opened up a lot of doors and a lot of connections, I was able to go work a lot of different camps as a player. And you know, a coach that had worked with me at the University of Kentucky said, hey, there's a coaching job at Washington State. Are you interested in coming in as a goalkeeper coach? And this is back in the day when we had restricted earning coaches, right? Where you can make no more than $12,000 a year as a second assistant, no more than $4,000 a year for camps. So I took a chance and I went for it. And, you know, bartended at night and coached during the daytime and traveled and did all that. And so that, you know, that started a 25-year journey of being a college coach. You know, spent 2.5 years at Washington State. I took some time off to go be a ski bum. And then I started coaching. And this, Don, I don't think I ever told you this, but I had a job offer at MTV to work for the vice president of MTV Music based on my bartending skills and my ability to handle customers in Sun Valley, Idaho. And that same week, Stacey Enos, who is a fantastic player at North Carolina, she got the job. She was at Utah State. And she said, hey, you know, do you want to come down here at Utah State and coach? And I'm like, man, MTV New York or coaching soccer at Utah State? Well, I took the Utah State job. And after that, you know, opened up some more doors. And Lisa Frazier, who was the head coach at Washington State prior to me getting there, connected with me, brought me down to University of Arizona, knew that I had connections in Arizona. I spent 2.5 years at Arizona, and then I became the head coach at NAU for 18 years. And that's my story.
Back of a story, Andre. I mean, that takes us all around the world. I love it. And I hadn't heard about your job offer that probably would have made you millions, but that's okay.
That's all right. I mean, I probably would have been handling, you know, high-end rock stars and causing me chaos in my life, but that's okay.
Okay. So, you know, I think you and I connected originally because of your buddy Ernie, right? Ernie Yarborough connected us, who also works with us, but former college coach, played goalkeeper also at Indiana, right?
Yep.
Poor Ernie had to back you up, right?
Yep.
So since you've been out, so let's see, you stepped away from NAU in what year?
December of 2018.
So yeah, December 18th, same season I stepped away. And then you went back and coached at Yavapai for 1 year, right?
Yeah, I did the COVID season, the spring and the fall with Mike when Mike retired and Hugh Bell retired.
Kind of fun closing the loop there, huh? Going back and coaching.
Yeah, you know, alma mater. You know, the critical mistake is you never go in after a legend retires because it's an impossible task. I'm like, man, and I kept telling people, I'm like, this is not the timeline that I wanted this to be. I wanted to be the person after. You know, after the next person, because
the only guy who had more guts than you, Andre, was Todd taking over after his dad. Not only your dad.
But he took over after, you know, Fry. So, you know, Fry had won a national championship, and then you know, so he had a little bit of a buffer. He had a buffer. I didn't have a buffer. It was like,
yeah.
Hey, all time winningest coach in junior college history, 7 national championships. Here you go. Follow that up. You know, like
So here's a question for you. So because you've been around at least as long as I have, how have you seen recruiting change, let's just say over the past 10 years, since iPhones became in everybody's pocket? How have you seen recruiting change?
I think in the past, people were more in tune to, hey, if I can get on a college roster, this is a huge privilege. Because when I started, there weren't that many programs around, you know, in 1994, 1995, you didn't have as many programs on both the men's and the women's side, specifically on the women's side. And there weren't that many opportunities. And so, you know, the Pac-12 barely started sponsoring teams. Not everybody was fully sponsored. And so I think when, you know, the recruiting process was deemed, this was for the elite of the elite. You know, and you had to have a certain level of play for a lot of kids. And you had some amazing clubs that catered specifically to certain colleges. It was like a pipeline to certain colleges, especially that I-25 corridor on the East Coast, right? With Mason and North Carolina and all of those teams. And then, you know, and then Clive, what I really noticed was the impact that Clive Charles had on college soccer on the women's side, you know, and what he did at Portland and how that kind of opened up that whole Northwest side. And because of the success that the Northwest had, I mean, UCLA was barely, you know, there was nothing to UCLA, and USC wasn't even the program. And, you know, and so it just kind of like this boom that happened. And people just looked at like, hey, if I can get to a program, this was great. And then somewhere along the line in the last 10 years, the whole concept of, hey, I need to be on a Power Five, right? The major conferences really kind of came into play. And the funding that came into those Power Fives and the exposure and the, you know, the marketing aspect of it really changed, I think, the narrative of recruiting. And meaning that the elite clubs were looking at now just like, hey, it's not about us getting our kids to college. It's now about us getting kids to these Power Five programs. And this is what
Andre, why don't you name the Power Fives for us? Because I know a lot of listeners don't understand what we're talking about
when we talk about Power Fives. Pac-12, ACC, SEC, Big 10, Big 12. Those are Power Fives, right?
Arguably on women's soccer, I throw in WCC. I mean, Santa Clara's one. Arguably.
Yeah, so I would say WCC in the sense of, hey, from a soccer standpoint. But in terms of a pure basketball, football, heavy conference massive TV revenue, massive TV exposure, massive marketing and national brand recognition.
How much money there is, yes, right.
Those conferences were the ones that really started kind of taking a foothold on the women's side. On the men, it didn't really matter because not every conference really sponsors men's soccer. I mean, the SEC doesn't have that. You know, the Big 12 doesn't have men's soccer. Pac-12, right. Not every school sponsored. And so, you know, even some schools in the Big 10, they don't have men's soccer. On the women's side, that became the thing that started changing things is as these programs started having bigger profiles, they were able to start getting some traction with the bigger clubs. And so that's where I saw the biggest difference was that, you know, especially when I first started in 2001 at NAU, you were able to, if you had scholarship money, you were able to get some traction with some of these clubs because kids needed a place to go play. And somewhere along the line, the narrative changed. And, you know, hey, you have zero chance of getting this kid because you're not a Power Five. It was kind of like the thought process with a lot of club coaches, like, oh, they're strictly looking at these type of schools. And so I think that's where things kind of changed a lot. And this image thing really kind of took a foothold in the youth game in terms of, hey, you know,
are you talking about name, image, likeness? Is that what you're talking about?
NIL? No, I'm just talking about image.
Okay.
What's the sweatshirt? What's the brand name I'm wearing across?
Yes.
You know, like in terms of like, hey, you know, when kids were committing and they're wearing their sweatshirts and all that's super cool. You know, that I think became a big thing. And that was difficult to manage as a mid-major. And you kind of had to re-strategize all of your recruiting as a mid-major because of it.
Right. Yeah, makes sense. Hey, since I brought it up inadvertently, it's something that I've never discussed on a podcast. What's your impression of name? First of all, if you want, we can talk about what it is. Name, image, likeness. Okay, so NIL, it's called. And how, if it affects soccer, in your opinion, if it's going to affect soccer, and if so, how? And if you want to describe what your understanding of it is, and we can talk about that a little bit. What's your impression of the name, image, likeness being allowed to be marketed by players that are playing in the NCAA?
You know, I'm not 100% proficient in understanding it completely. I mean, I haven't delved a lot, but a lot of this came out of that whole, you know, Ed and Charles O'Bannon case, you know, saying, hey, EA Sports was, you know, using our image and likeness in their video game promotions and they're making profiting money, but, you know, you're using our name, our you know, not our name, but our image and likeness in terms of like the player qualities that I had, and, you know, setting that up in the players that were being used for your basketball games, and then also NCAA football, EA sports. So that kind of, that's kind of how that, that whole trend, you know, like of why are you getting to profit off of my, you know, off of my image and likeness as a school, but I can't recover any money and I can't make any money off of who I am. And so, you know, on the one hand, I think that there is a lot of validity to that. Like, you know, why can't a kid, you know, use their, you know, their branding, their name to make money for themselves, right? I think there's some good aspects of it. But man, it, you know, it can get carried away, you know, because now from a recruiting standpoint, how do you compete against that? You know, when I look at, you know, football and basketball, the amount of money that's being thrown out there now to these kids, to these players, to leverage, you know, one school to the other, you know, how's that going to impact men's soccer? And I know for a fact, you know, that there's programs going around, you know, saying, hey, we need to figure out how to do this for us to retain our players. And so I have like mixed emotions by it. I'm like, you know, number one, good for you if you can market yourself and you can brand yourself. But I do have an issue with, you know, how schools are going about getting money and how they're allocating money to specific sports. And how does that impact from a Title IX standpoint? How's that going to, you know, trickle down with different sports? It's a slippery slope, but I mean, I'm just not really that well versed that I feel really 100% comfortable.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's just a general, and I'm not either, to be honest. We'll have to, yeah. I've got a couple of attorney buddies, you know, that'll have to weigh in on this, but.
Yeah, and you know, one thing, Don, that I really, like, this is where it kind of stood out for me. It was 2 weeks ago, I had a parent ask me, like, well, how can you help us with our name, image, and likeness, and my kid's branding? I was just like, what, excuse me? You know, like, yeah, we want to figure out how to profit off of this, right? And I kind of was taken aback by that. And I'm like, well, number one, that's not what we do. It's not what I do. You know, I'm trying to help your kid get into college. But that's a legitimate question that people are asking now. Like, you know, how does this school help my kid's branding so I can make money off of this later on? And I mean, I don't know if that's a healthy way to go about doing things. I mean, there's a business sense of it, and I don't know where it's going to head and how it's going to go. But I just see it expediting the transfer market exponentially.
Yeah, and let's be real. When we're talking about this, this was primarily brought about because of football and basketball. Schools were losing players to the NBA right away and to NFL quicker than they wanted. They wanted to hang on to these players because there's money to be made on these players as well as wanting to win. And a lot of this was brought out because players need to make money. A lot of these players do need the money. And this was part of it. So how much is it going to affect soccer? I don't know. Time will tell, right? That's a tough one.
Yeah, but I do see the current trend, though, Don, what I see is that, yeah, we're going to have more and more younger players leave, not go to college in soccer. You know, they're both, you could see it, you already see it happening. It's on the men's side, it already happens. On the women's side, you're starting to see that trend. Some little bit of a trickle effect starting to come in where 16, 17-year-olds are bypassing college and going straight to pro.
Yeah,
and it's going to happen.
What do you think about that? What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's having grown up overseas, it's common. It's going to happen. You know, I don't know how the child labor laws and all the other things that are going to, how that gets impacted. But I do feel at some point in time, clubs are going to try to figure out how to profit off of that. Youth clubs, like, hey, you know, we spent 4 years working with this kid. We want compensation. And if that ever gets sorted out, then it's game on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Okay. So, So let's just back up just a little bit here, Andre. How do you see your role at SRUSA? Let's talk about your current role with the company, what you're doing, why you're doing it. We talk about ethics, and how we do what we do, why we do what we do, and how you see that in your role with SRUSA.
All right. So, I mean, I think for me, the biggest thing is that, you know, I spent 26 years being a collegiate coach, and I've got a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge in terms of how things operate. And I love the fact that I can consult and help kids understand what the process is going to be like and really maybe take some of the myths away and help them ask the right questions out of themselves. Because not everybody's going to be a pro as a soccer player, and not everybody's going to get a chance to play for, you know, a national title contender every year. But for the kid that's really, you know, passionate about the game, wants to use soccer as a way of getting to further their education, then I feel like what I do adds a ton of value. Number one, in the world of business, I look at a lot of this like in the world of business, right? So the number one point of sales, and I was in sales a long time ago. The number one point of sales is that you have to have a point of commonality whenever you are dealing with a new client or you're trying to get a new job or something like that. Most of the time, everybody is sending out emails, you know, they're throwing things on Twitter or whatever it is. I say that's like doing cold calls, right? In the world of sales, cold call meaning that you don't know the person, you don't have a common point that connects you from, you know, between the coach and yourself, and you're just sending an email and you're hoping that they open the inbox and that they see the email and that they're like, oh, this looks interesting, I'm going to look at it. That doesn't really happen with college coaches, specifically with head coaches. Usually they're passing that on straight to the assistant coach. And then the assistant coach has got their inbox already slammed. They're doing the other work, like setting up travel and all this other stuff, official visits. And then all of a sudden the head coach is forwarding on this information. So a lot of that stuff gets lost in the shuffle, right? And honestly, I think a lot of coaches, what they'll do, they'll take the information, they'll put them on a spreadsheet, and they'll say, hey, this is going to be our spreadsheet for camp. These are all the kids that are interested. Let's send out a camp invite. But for me, what I feel like I add the most value is not only from a consulting and saying, hey, what are the things that are important to you? Where are your values? What is it that you want? What is it that you need? But it's about opening up the doors and looking to connect with a college coach and saying, hey, this is Andre. How are you doing? What's going on? How's recruiting going? What's your room? What do you like? What's 2023 look like for you? 2024 look like for you? What are going to be your needs? Well, I'm going to need this, 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 and this. Okay. Well, listen, do me a favor. You take 3 minutes, look at this video I'm going to send you. Tell me what you think. They'll look at it and they're like, you know what? It's not going to be a good fit. It's not what we need right now. I need something more of this. It gives me an idea. Or like, yeah, this looks interesting. Well, tell me a little bit more about this kid. So I think that's where I add, you know, the value is that number one, basically just cut the chase and just get right to the point. Get an immediate answer and immediate feedback for a player. And it's either, hey, there's an interest, let's further this conversation, or no, this is done, it's over. You know, they're not interested. It's time for you to move into a different direction. So finding that, you know, trying to open as many doors as possible for kids is really something that I like doing because I feel like I'm adding value. But the other thing too is, you know, is the mentorship, right? Is the ability for a kid to call you during a visit or call you at a camp or calling you during the recruiting process and trying to get, you know, some feedback on things that are going on is, I think, is invaluable. You know, I talked to you a lot about, you know, about this, Don, and I feel like my job is to identify players, evaluate the level that I feel that they would have success, educate them on the recruiting process and what it's all about, and then help place them. That's really what I try to do, is identify, evaluate, you know, educate them on the process and how this is going to work out, talk about the schools and different things. And then, hey, how can I connect you and how can I help place you? And that's where I think what it's what I do. Much like, you know, my analogy was, look, I might be able to go on YouTube and search some stuff about how to fix my car, but I have zero knowledge on it. I don't have the tools to do it. And if I screw this up, it's probably going to cost me a lot more in the end. So I'm going to find a mechanic that is reputable. I'm going to find a mechanic that I can trust, and I'm going to go to that mechanic and be assured that, hey, this is somebody that knows what they're talking about. Right. And that's kind of like what I do.
Yeah. I mean, we do honestly talk about this. If people can do for themselves, you can always do it yourself, but I've re-roofed my own house. I'll never do that again. It was horrible. So you can do it, but it does. It just takes time, effort, and money. Like I say, time is money, and our time is valuable. So having resources to help them helps. So Andre, one other subject I really do want to talk about, because it comes up on a daily basis, and we'll be getting in another couple of months, the winter camp season will heat up really, really good in the next couple of months, as soon as the playing season starts to wind down. You've been involved in some of the biggest camps in the country, including the Indiana camp, actually, that you just came back from working, didn't you? Let's talk. I want to hear your take on camps, unbiased from what I think. But I want to hear your take on camps. Here's what I want to know. How effective are camps for players showing up? How can players maximize their use of a camp? And what's the most effective way for players to utilize camps?
Okay. So I've had some communication with some coaches about a kid that is struggling to get seen. They're in a great situation, playing at a really, really high level, just can't get the exposure because he's not here. He's overseas, right? Everybody likes the video. Everybody likes what they see. But the very first question they ask me is, when can I see him live? That's legitimate. That's a legitimate concern by a college coach, because they're like, you know, I'm going to take especially the high, high profile schools. If I'm going to take a risk and I've got limited roster spots, and some of these schools, and I think this is what, you know, I think a lot of recruits don't understand and their families don't understand, is a lot of these schools have limits and caps in terms of how many players they can carry on a roster. They're being capped by their schools. And so if they've got limited roster spots, they are more inclined to need multiple evaluations to make a decision on a player than, say, another school that maybe has, you know, 38. I mean, there's some schools that have 52 kids on their roster, like, honestly, right?
And right. Some, like, schools, you know, aren't capped. Right. In fact, some schools are telling them coaches, they'll get us more players.
Yeah. They encourage it. So it's a revenue generator for the school, right? They have a varsity team and a JV team. So for the schools that are capped, the evaluation process is important. And so when I get that feedback directly from a college coach saying, hey, I like he or she, I need to see him though in person. can you relay that information? And I will. And the kid will ask, is it, you think this is worthwhile? I'm like, yes, they're genuinely interested. They just need to see you in person in some capacity. And they haven't had a chance to. So I think there's huge value to that. You know, there's a sense of urgency. There's a winter ID camp coming up. They like you. They just need to see you live, right? And so, and there's a difference. There's a huge difference. You know, Don and I, you and I talked about this. There's a huge difference between recruiting on film and seeing a person live, and then recruiting a player in the evening and recruiting a player during the daytime. There's something about the lights that makes everybody faster, right? And so the good coaches really understand that, and they want to see that kid live in person so they can assess, number one, their athleticism. Number two, what are they doing off the ball? And they want to see where are the mistakes, because everyone sends highlights. Nobody sends low lights. And that's why the coaches will always ask, can you send me a half, like a half of a game, a good game, so I can watch them and see when they make mistakes, how bad is their touch? What's their thought process? So I think from the ID camp standpoint, that's great. Where I think people have to get, you know, be really, really careful with is that you can get sucked into a trap where next thing you know, you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars traveling all over the country, you know, to go to camp. And let's be honest, if there's a camp, a parent usually goes and stays the duration. There's not that many families that just let put their kids on a plane, especially now with how flight cancellations are happening. So, you know, two people are traveling, they're getting hotels stay. I mean, these, a $500 camp is not a $500 camp. It's a $1,600 to $1,800 investment, right? And it's a gamble. And it's, you know, there's, hey, I really want to go to this camp. I want to see the school. Okay, well, let me tell you, you know, there's going to be 150 other campers there. You better showcase yourself. And that's where I provide some advice saying, hey, they're not really looking for midfielders this year. So you're going to go to this camp and you're only looking for two kids, and they already have two of those kids that they're looking at. It's already come to camp. You're telling me that you're willing to go over there, showcase yourself with the hope that, hey, first time assessment, you're going to beat out these two other kids that they watched four or five different times. So I think you have to be careful about that. And then the biggest one, and I hated doing these, and I really fought this a lot, was the one-day identification camps. And third-party camps, there's some value to them because some, you know, maybe they get some exposure to some different coaches. But I really feel like those one-day ID camps or one-and-a-half-day ID camps really does not help the player, specifically because it's just not enough time for a coach to evaluate you, 15 minutes. Right now, if you're going to a goalkeeper specific camp or a striker camp, that's like a positional camp, 1.5 days, yes, you can get four sessions in, you can get some serious work in. But if you're going to a camp where, you know, you got to do a warm up, you got to do small sided technical, you got to do something, you play one game, you hope that you get a 30 minute game in, and who knows what the players are, and all of a sudden you just wasted a full day, a day and a half of your time, and you spent $150, $200 to go to the camp, and you really didn't get anything out of it. So there's three levels of ID camps. The coach really needs to see you play, but you have to have somebody communicate that effectively with the coach and with the player, right? And that's, I think, where I come in, and I have these really serious conversations with the coaches and saying, hey, how serious are you about this kid? What is it that you like? And what is it that you don't like? And then I can give that feedback too, to the player. Like, you know, I have one player, I'm like, they question your mobility. You gotta do this at camp. Your transitional moments has to be better.
Right.
They like you, but they feel like you lag this. And so that's where the advice I come in. Because a college coach is not going to tell a recruit, hey, I like you, but, you know, we struggle in your transitional phase. So when you come to camp, this is what you have to do. Very rarely is that ever communicated.
No, 100%. Well, I think that's going to help a lot of people, that advice. And because we talk about this a lot, that the groundwork has to be properly laid in order to maximize the opportunity that you're getting at a camp. Walking in cold, I always say, it's kind of like somebody from the Midwest moving to Hollywood, walking down the Hollywood Walk of Fame and hoping to be discovered. Yeah, I'm sure there's producers around you, and I'm sure there's directors around you. You don't know who they are, and it becomes very difficult to be discovered. But laying the groundwork properly, I think, helps a lot. Got to get eyes on you. Well, Andre, do you have any other thing that you want to leave us with before we wrap this up? Any other thoughts that have been going through your head about the recruiting process or the state of college soccer or anything that's been weighing on your mind?
I got a lot. I don't think we have enough time.
We can always come back and do another one of these, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing for me is that, you know, I've seen it all from a non-recruited player to being a walk-on JUCO, you know, junior college player, to earning, you know, national accolades as a junior college player, and then going to a, you know, a preeminent powerhouse Division I program and having to be, you know, in that environment, to struggling, you know, as an assistant coach, to being a head coach at a mid-major, being an assistant coach at a Power Five. So the thing that I would say to every kid that's out there, anybody that's looking at the recruiting process, is go where you're wanted. Okay. Go where you're wanted. And don't associate dollar value for what your personal value is as a player or as a person. Sometimes there just isn't any money, right? If I would have gone back in 1989, in April of 1989, and Mike Pantaleon would have told me, hey, listen, we don't have any money, but I'm giving you an opportunity. And I would have said, oh my gosh, I can't believe how, you know, how offensive that is, that as a junior college, first year junior college program, you're not even offering me a substantial scholarship to come to school here. And I would have turned that away. My story would have been completely different. And so what I knew is that he wanted me, that he needed me. He just didn't have the budget for it at the time. And, you know, and so I always tell kids, be mindful of where you're looking at. Number one, does it fit your budget as a family? I think that's really important, right, Don? We talk about this a lot. Does it fit your budget as a family? Is it going to break you to go to school there? Does it offer what you would want to study from an academic standpoint and enough majors that you can explore different options? Number three, can you feel like you're at home? Because you're going to have 148 hours of the week that you're not going to be a student athlete. You know, are you comfortable there? Are you feel safe there? Do you feel like you're going to be entertained enough? Are you going to be engaged enough? Is there things that you want to do that you're passionate about outside of school? And does the soccer tie into it? And then, you know, the very last thing is this, is that regardless of what anybody tells you in the beginning of, hey, I just want to be a part of your program, I don't care how much playing time I get, that's so bogus. Because the number 100%. One complaint players have, the number one complaint that players have after they leave is playing time. Yes. Why? Because they tie in their playing time with their value as a human being, as a person, for some reason. It's their identity. Right. And that conversation that you have with the coach, that before you commit and you're like, oh, I just want to be a part of the program, really think about that, how you're going to feel 4 years from now, from that point, if you don't play a lot.
Are you just Andre, here's how I kind of lay it out to the kids today, because I think almost everybody probably has an Instagram account and probably checks it fairly regularly. How is it going to feel when you are the 28th player on a roster, the coach is only traveling 20, eight of you are staying home alone in your dorm rooms, week one, week two, week three, week six, week 10, and you're not traveling. You don't really feel like you're part of the team, yet you have to put in the 5 a.m. weight room sessions, and you've got to go to the team study table, and you got to go to training, and you got to put it all in, and you're not really part of it. Now, I've got friends. I had a friend of mine that went to University of Virginia back in the Bruce Arena days when they were winning national championship after national championship, and he never played all 4 years, and said that he would do it again. He was happy just to be with Miola and Renya and these guys on the national team. He was happy just to be there. I would say that that guy is absolutely a unicorn. Very hard to find, very rare. Most of us want to play, and most of us want to contribute.
Different era though, because now it's the social media aspect of it, and you know, very different era back then. And you know, and I think that, man, I just really, my biggest regret as a coach is I wish I would have stood firmer on not having bigger rosters when I was asked to have bigger rosters.
Really? Yeah.
That's my biggest regret. I wish at some point in time, and if I could give any advice to a young college coach getting in there, I would say, put it in your contract and ask, this is the max my roster is.
Fascinating.
Because
yeah, and it makes sense to me.
And you know, and I'm like, I dealt with four different ADs or five different ADs in the span of 18 years. And everybody had a different requirement in terms of what they viewed your roster size should be. Sometimes they're like, hey, you should carry 22. Some of them are like 24 to 22 because it costs too much money to feed and house them all. Right. Okay. We need 41. Why do you need 41? Well, we need to show that we are producing profit for the college. And if you have 14 scholarships and you have 41 players on the roster, you know, you've got 27 players playing full cost of attendance. Now you're generating, you know, X amount of dollars in terms of revenue. And now we can justify having athletics. I mean, those are conversations that are real, right? And so the number one regret I had was not standing firmer on, hey, this is the amount of rosters I would want, and just sticking to it.
Yeah.
Because I knew how kids felt.
Yes. And I agree. That's at 100%. That's my same experience. Everybody wants to play, and everybody says they're willing to put in the time and the effort to wait to get there until it happens to them. And then all of a sudden it's not okay anymore. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Can you imagine being a player now? Like when coaches require them to stand for 90 minutes during a game, cheering on the sideline, standing on the side. I never understood that. Like, why are you guys standing for 90 minutes? Get off your feet. You know, but doing that for 4 years, you're basically your cheerleader. You might as well.
Right. By the way, there are cheerleading scholarships out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, thanks, Andre, for coming on, man. I feel like we've got, I love to hear the story. And I really am thrilled to have you on board at SRUSA. You've added a tremendous amount of value to our kids, helping them. And thanks for coming on the Inside College Soccer Podcast.
Awesome. Thank you.